I'm Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight. This is Eva Herr, and thanks for listening. Tonight we have with us Dr. Richard Smoley, and we're going to talk about his book, The Dice Game of Shiva. And it's not sitting Shiva like when someone dies in a Jewish household, which is what I thought when the book came in. It's actually a fabulous book about consciousness. How are you, Dr. Smoley?
I'm very well, thank you.
Okay, so before we get started, why don't you tell us just a little bit about you, your background, how you came to do what you do, and how people can reach you.
Very good.
Are you there?
Yes. People can reach me through my website, which is www.innerchristianity.com. Inner Christianity is the title of one of my previous books, which is about the esoteric dimension of Christianity that has something to do with some of the subjects we're talking about tonight.
Okay. And your website again, just to make sure.
Excuse me? Oh, it's www.innerchristianity.com.
Okay. And what is your background and your educational background?
I have degrees in classics and philosophy from Harvard and Oxford universities, and became interested in these subjects while I was studying, particularly at Oxford. Later on, I worked as editor of a magazine called Gnosis, which was a journal of the Western inner traditions, and gave me more exposure to some of these ideas. And wrote several books, one of which is called Hidden Wisdom, and it's a guide to the Western esoteric traditions. Today, I work as editor of Quest Magazine, which is the Journal of the Theosophical Society of America, and also editor of Quest Books, which is the Theosophical Society's book imprint.
Okay. So my first question is to you, so that we're all on the same page about what we're talking about. What is your definition of consciousness? What is that to you?
Well, as I say in The Dice Game of Shiva, it's capacity to relate self and other. And consciousness is often defined in an extremely circular way, indicating that people don't really understand it. What is consciousness? Well, it's awareness. Well, what is awareness? Well, it's mind. Well, what is mind? Well, it's consciousness. And this can be kind of hard to break, but seeing consciousness as the capacity to relate self and the other, it's not a circular definition. And a lot of contemporary studies rely on this concept, even though they may not define it this way. For example, the current issue of Time magazine, which has a cover article on animal intelligence, I mean, there's a line here that says, orangutans have such a strong sense of the difference of self and other that they will preen at their own reflection. So essentially, this article, and obviously working from a lot of cognitive studies of, you know, animal consciousness and capacity, is, you know, saying that this capacity to relate self and other is the hallmark of consciousness. Now, my view of it is slightly different from that of a conventional science, in that, and science is coming around to this to a degree, in that, you know, for example, this article is saying, well, animals, you know, have more consciousness than we might have thought. But consciousness is still defined in some sort of human-centric way. You know, here in the same article, bivalves, you know, like clams and oysters, no smarts to speak of, may well lack even consciousness. Well, no doubt that's true to a degree, but even a bivalve has to have some concept of a world around it, you know, so that it can intake food, you know, that it can excrete, can reproduce. produce, that kind of thing. Now, this is not some kind of Cartesian, you know, self-reflective consciousness, but it's still consciousness of a kind. Similarly, you could say that of plants, and again, where I would probably go further than, you know, conventional thought is saying that, well, even supposedly inanimate objects must have some kind of rudimentary sense of consciousness. That is to say, how does a hydrogen atom know how to recognize an oxygen atom and react with it in a certain way to make water? I mean, it must have some, I mean, a very, very rudimentary sense of a self and other, but some nonetheless. And if you view it this way, you know, consciousness is, you know, organic to the entire universe, and nothing in a sense can exist without it.
That reminds me of Cleve Baxter's research that he did with some of the people at HeartMath, you know, where he put the electrodes on the egg and held the egg over the boiling water, and the egg knew that it was about to be boiled.
Yeah.
It reacted, you know. Anyway, go ahead. Did you have something to say about that?
No, but I mean, I think it indicates that, you know, consciousness is much more pervasive and widespread than people think. Human consciousness is one sort of, you know, very specialized and, you know, according to our own criteria, highly privileged form of this. But the view I'm talking about, consciousness, where it is since present in everything, living and apparently non-living, it does a couple of things. For one thing, it does, perhaps unfortunately, reduce the human sense of uniqueness and, you know, privilege in possessing this thing called consciousness. On the other hand, it makes us more organically connected to the world around us, say that our capacity to relate self and other, you know, is a specialized form of something that, you know, makes it possible for anything to exist at all.
Do you think that the presence of sensate awareness or cognitive awareness or both assure that consciousness is active? Are these attributes of consciousness?
I'm sorry, could you
I'm going to have a lot of complicated questions like that for you. I hope it's okay. And if you don't know, just let me know and I'll move on to the next one.
Well, I didn't really hear it properly.
Okay. Do you think that the presence of sensate or awareness or cognitive awareness or both assure that consciousness is active? Do you think that these are attributes of consciousness?
Yeah, I mean, they're just, you know, subcategories of what I've been talking about already. Like, to sense something, well, what are you doing when you're sensing something? You're sensing, you know, an other, whatever that may be. So it's simply, you know, a subcategory of this larger capacity to relate self and other.
Okay. Do you think that consciousness could be active without the presence of either one of these attributes or signifiers? And in the latter, would it be correct to say that consciousness exists merely in potentia?
Well, this is kind of a subtle question, because in certain types of meditative consciousness, people will say, you know, there's consciousness without an object. And, you know, mystical experience often starts to break down this kind of barrier of self and other that we normally associate with consciousness. And I think these kinds of cognitive states are real and they exist. The fact is that ordinary language and ordinary concepts aren't really very well defined, really able to speak of them very well, so that the mystic, you know, has to use paradoxical, enigmatic language. And of course, you know, people who don't have anything like mystical experience, you know, assume he's talking rubbish. I mean, that's what the typical, you know, scientistic, materialistic worldview has to say about mysticism. So yes, I think that consciousness is possible beyond, you know, say a consciousness without an object, consciousness without, you know, possibly an other, but it starts getting into a realm where ordinary concepts and ordinary words don't apply and don't fit it very well.
Linguistics is definitely a problem. That's one reason I'm asking you all these questions, because the thing that started it was when I first had my enlightenment experience, you know, when that happens to you, you're excited for a long time. You think you're going to change the world, and you talk about it. And so I would ask different people, you know, talk about consciousness, and I'd say, what's your definition? I was in the grocery store line one day, and this doctor looked at me like I was stupid, and he said, well, it's the opposite of being asleep. So I went, oh, God, you know, no wonder nobody can have a conversation and understand one another. So that's why I'm asking you all of these kinds of questions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in terms of sleep, now, in say, deep sleep without, you know, a dreamless sleep, you're not the conscious, the ego is not aware of anything, but still the body possesses a consciousness of a kind.
Where does ego go when you sleep?
Yeah, and, you know, for example, what's the most commonly prescribed remedy for illness? You know, it's sleep, you know, get more sleep. You know, the fact that while the mind is asleep and not really doing anything, the body can more effectively fight off these others called pathogens. So there is a level of consciousness that operates even during deep sleep, although it's not usually characterized that way.
Where do you think ego goes when you sleep? I've never asked that question, but it made me think of that when you said it.
Well, it goes either into a state of quiescence, or it goes into you know, some kind of alternative dream realm. Now, notice, I mean, even in dreams, there's an awareness of self and other. Now, supposedly, characters, objects, and dreams are, you know, have no objective reality. That is to say, nobody else experiences them except you, so they're completely subjective and, you know, for the most part, regarded as you know, imaginary. But even there's a self and an other in the dream state. This ego consciousness, this I versus, you know, a world around me is not in many ways the same as it is in the waking life. You know, you can do things in dreams, things happen in dreams that can't happen in real life, things change into other things all the time, and, you know, you can fly and so on, but there's still, you know, this sense of a self and other in this dream world.
So you said in your book, one thing you said in your book is that unimpeded sense of self usually occurs first thing in the morning. Is that why?
Well, one thing in the book I said is that, you know, there is often a brief stage in just upon waking where, you know, there's an awareness, you know, a world around you, but the sense of I has not really kind of locked in yet. And, you know, usually this only lasts a couple of seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the I sort of comes into existence. And then, you know, in addition to having all of this, you know, you have the usual problems and worries and so on. And, you know, everything is regrettably back to normal. Now, you know, that whole stage, that whole process, it's something that I've related to certain Hindu concepts, notably the Sankhya philosophy, which is the oldest and, you know, in my view, the most profound of the Hindu philosophies. That sense of being aware of, you know, a world when you just awaken before the ego is locked in is what they call buddhi, you know, which is translated all sorts of ways, you know, from understanding to intuition and so on. But it's really this kind of, you know, pure cognition that, you know, unimpeded by an ego. Then the ego kind of comes in, and the Hindus call that ahankara, which simply means I-ness or I-am-ness. And then manas, which is ordinary mind, comes in, which is the train of thoughts and agendas and feelings and, you know, things that, you know, kind of go through our heads most of the day. So I think this fairly simple experience, which, you know, I certainly have often enough, and I imagine most people do in one way or another, illustrates some of the ideas of this apparently arcane Hindu philosophy.
Okay, cognitive awareness implies thinking, which infers brain processing. Does mind think, or does it simply know?
Well,
we're not talking about brain thinking. We know brain, well, that's a good question for you. Does brain think, or does it process? And then does mind think, or does it simply know?
Well, consciousness, going back to that, is, you know, is this awareness of another. And one thing that immediately becomes obvious once you're aware of this other world, shall we say, and that's what one of the things that esoteric Christianity talks about, the world, and there's a lot in the New Testament about the world. That's another, you know, subject. The one thing you notice about this world immediately is that it's constantly changing, and it's constantly in flux. Now, in our state of awareness, in ordinary human life, mind, you know, consciousness in its pure form is somehow enmeshed in this world. It does things, it acts, and one of these types of acts that it does is thinking. So
you're saying mind thinks?
And so yeah, that's the way I would put it.
Okay. I just want to make sure I was understanding correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And brain, does it think?
Well, the brain is obviously the organ for consciousness. If you believe the textbooks and the scientists, no type of consciousness is possible without the brain. But it turns out from, you know, all sorts of paranormal experience, and this is, you know, practically universal, the near-death experience, you know, the where, you know, consciousness exists even when the brain is, you know, flatlining. You know, science doesn't really want to deal with this, at least conventional science doesn't, for the simple reason that you know, requires too much of a change in its model, and they don't really understand it. The typical scientific view is that consciousness is an epiphenomenon, you know, kind of a side effect of brain activity.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll certainly see a lot of, you know, cognitive scientists saying that. Unfortunately, you know, they never really are quite able to explain how what we call consciousness actually, how it actually arises out of brain activity. And what it really has to do with it. And, you know, the more kind of radically materialistic the philosophers, which there are, you know, a fair number these days, you know, just simply deny that this is a problem.
Yeah, it puts them in a bad spot, especially because in one way they believe that everything's materialistic and that these miracles can't happen, but then they have to admit that miracles happen for these things to happen, such as spontaneous remission or something.
Yeah, well, the thing about it is that, you know, a lot of materialistic science is just very arrogant and, you know, anything that does not follow in terms of its, you know, fairly circumscribed model of what's supposed to happen is either denied or just, you know, assumed not to exist. But this cuts out so much of, you know, human experience that it's not really sustainable. You know, and it's not even very scientific in that there's a lot of empirical evidence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a human religious experience, it just doesn't want to deal with this. It can't look at it, and you know, so it just pretend it's not there. But
yeah.
You know, the sign of a, you know, a complete, you know, worldview is a willingness to, you know, see everything that's there and to deal, account for it in some sort of way, not to just deny it or deny its existence because it doesn't fit in your preconceptions.
So what do you believe to be the source of intention?
Well, the source of intention goes back to this fundamental engagement of consciousness with the world. Again, going back to the Hindus and Buddhists, liberation, enlightenment, is often portrayed as a kind of freeing of consciousness, a freeing of mind, awareness, whatever you like, from its enmeshment in the world. We are not, for the most part, at that situation. So our consciousness is enmeshed in the world. And one of the things we do is intending. Now, intending is a weird word, and the 20th century phenomenologists used it in a rather bizarre way. But I'm using it in more or less the familiar form that most people understand by it. The phenomenologists Husserl and all those people said that consciousness is intending, but it turned out they meant something rather different from intending than everybody else does. And,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's another problem in philosophy. You start inventing words or using them in a bizarre way that there's a certain power gain in there that, you use it in this kind of specialized kind of hieratic language. And everybody else has to, learn your specialized hieratic language. And the only way you can do that is to kind of absorb your philosophy. So it just becomes this very self-involved thing. And that's why philosophy used to be like considered the queen of science, the queen of knowledge. And today philosophy is simply not taken very seriously, even in the intellectual world. The continental philosophers, play these arcane games and constructions, verbiage that even they themselves don't seem to understand. The Anglo-American analytic philosophers, who are dominant in the English-speaking world are kind of, annoying kind of little brothers to science saying, we're scientific too, and we really believe in you science guys and all that sort of thing. But, unfortunately they don't have very much that's terribly original and interesting to add the standard scientific view, and that's why, philosophy is not taken seriously these days.
What do you believe to be the source of creativity? And what I mean is, where does creativeness come from? Does it come from us, from mind, from our individual local ego mind, or does it come from a higher source? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Beethoven, what became a prodigy at 2 or 3? Where'd that come from?
Mm-hmm. The answer to that question is I don't know. I mean, a typical esoteric philosopher would say it was it might have been a skill acquired in a past life, but do I know that that's the case? No, I don't. I would say this, that creativity, the Hindus again have the word for something like this, kind of the primordial force of the universe, which they call Shakti. And all of the forms in the universe, all of the birds and the bees, the earth and so on, are, shall we say, manifestations of this primordial energy, which we don't, for the most part, have direct access to, except in these forms. Creativity is somehow managing to engage with this dynamic creative force and, in a sense, help give birth to, some of its manifestations. And that may well explain why, true creativity often has a very given feeling about it. Norman Mailer once said that a novel is not, really made, it's given. Mozart apparently heard his music in his head and, his work, as far as he was concerned, was just writing it down in standard musical notation. So creativity is like this primordial force in the universe, and our human creativity is a capacity to tap into that in some sort of way, but I don't think people, understand terribly well, even and often the most creative people.
Do you think that intention, and this time when I'm using the word intention, I mean, I guess basically prayer is a good description for it. intending, you know, praying or placing out a thought that you would like to occur, do you believe that intention can manifest into physical reality based on what we do? And then I'm going to ask you, I have a follow-up question for that, depending on your answer.
Yeah. I mean, the standard practice in magic, and magic of all kinds, is to, in a sense, take a thought form, invest it with creative energy so that eventually it manifests in the world. Now, this usually doesn't work all that well, or let's put it this way, it's very, very hard to make this work without having backfire in some sort of way. Mm-hmm. But the fact that it backfires doesn't mean that it isn't real. You know, I have enough of my own experience to say that I would say that it is real. So that prayer and intention do, you know, in certain ways manifest in the world. You know, the more intensely you invest them with energy, you know, the more powerful they become. They do sometimes become a bit of a sorcerer's apprentice, and you know, they're not always quite what you intended them to be, or they kind of get a little bit out of control. But you know, nonetheless, I think the power is real enough.
Okay. So do you think, because I believe that they can, but I don't think that, like you said, it's a very hard thing to do. It's not that easy. So do you think that it matters whether you get into an altered state of mind like low theta or high delta so that you have a very cohesive field to try and make that occur? Otherwise, first thing people are going to say, well, why can't I manifest that new car in my driveway? You know, and do you think that it takes time? You know, you're living today, that what you intended 20 years ago.
Well,
even though you may not have known you intended it.
Yeah. Well, I would say, you know, in answer to the first question, what's chiefly operative is focusing and concentrating on this desired thing, whatever it is. And doing so in a very clear and consistent way. Most people who want something and don't get it are consciously or usually unconsciously, you know, they're afraid of getting it. They, you know, want it, but at the same time, and almost the same degree, they believe they won't get it. You know, so the focus on the intention is not very clear. And all of the, you know, the new thought models and all of the, you know, best-selling books about this sort of thing say the same thing, and it works. You know, but it works to a greater degree of focus you have. The second part of the question, if you can remind me what that is, asked me if it needed to be in a particular brain state. Oh, and whether it manifests in time. Well, time is an extremely peculiar thing, and it's no one really seems to know what time is. St. Augustine said, you know, if nobody asks me, I know what time is, but, you know, if somebody asks me what time is, I'm immediately unable to say.
I say right
and,
now time.
yeah. I mean, the one thing you can say about it is that it is part of, you know, the, you know, basic structure by which we experience the world. There are hints of that in the Kabbalistic tradition, which would be too much of a digression to talk about now. But there does seem to be, you know, some kind of ripeness. That is to say, something can happen immediately, or it can happen, you know, 20 years from now. To say that, why exactly this is, I don't really know. And I think, you know, certain, you could say that one speculation is that, you know, certain astrological influences, you know, make it possible for something to manifest. That's probably as good an account as anywhere, or at least astrological events or planetary conjunctions seem to make it possible for certain things to manifest in a way that, you know, they might not have been able to before.
Do you believe that we have complete free will? And what I mean by that is, of course, we have free will to sit here and have this conversation or, you know, go and decide we need something to drink. But do you think we have complete free will? Are we driving the car? And I'm going to tell you a little story that I tell to give you a better idea. I tell a story that you're a little three-year-old sitting in the back seat of a car, and you're strapped into a car seat with a little yellow steering wheel. And you believe with all your heart that you're driving that car. So God is in the front seat, or whatever you want to call it, source, irreducible unit, whatever you want to call it, is in the front seat using that steering wheel. And you come up to the red light, and the playground's on the right, and the grocery store is on the left, and, of course, you want to go to the playground. God, or whatever you want to call it, wants to go to the grocery store. We know whose steering wheel is going to work. So if we had complete free will, you could turn that yellow steering wheel and go into the playground. So, and we would never forget anything. You know, you wouldn't have forgotten our last interview, or I wouldn't have lost your number. What is your perspective on free will?
Well, I think in the true sense, free will at a human level operates, you know, at a much higher stage of consciousness than the ordinary ego, as consciousness than the ordinary ego is. Most mystical traditions, you know, portray the human makeup as to a certain extent hierarchical. You know, the lowest level, kind of the body with its drives, then there's the conscious ego, then you rapidly get into the level of super consciousness, which the ordinary mind doesn't really have access to very often. And at these levels, you know, the self, you know, has something approaching free will. But the conscious ego is much more limited in its respect, and its capacity to choose is, you know, a lot more restricted and specific. You know, the conscious ego can kind of choose whether to have another cup of coffee in the morning.
I have a question there. Excuse me. Do you believe we live in a hologram? Do you really believe the universe is holographic?
I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of scientific or scientific-like concepts that are used in, explaining, you know, consciousness or mind these days, holographic universe, quantum realities, that sort of thing. I think you're always on dangerous ground if you take those metaphors too literally.
I think that
a hologram, just like certain quantum mechanical concepts, are very useful metaphors to see things. But to say, mind is a quantum force, or mind is literally a hologram, is probably a step further than I would care to go.
I guess what I'm referring to is it's a fact in quantum mechanics that there's no mass on the quantum level. Would you agree?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing about it is, I think that these ideas, you know, give us a certain kind of permission and a certain kind of freedom in thinking about these things. Whether mind itself operates in the sort of way that the formula of quantum mechanics might indicate, you know, is a question. I don't understand quantum theory but I'm not sure. You know, I think it's sort of become, you know, almost like a gimmick. You know, there's this thing called quantum theory, and it's explains lots of things, so it sounds kind of weird and far out. So, you know, our own weird far out things can be used in terms of that. And most things I have read, you know, and heard about, you know, likening quantum theory to consciousness, you know, has a little bit of that kind of forced quality to it.
Okay. Well, I was going to say, because I thought you were going to say yes, you thought that. I was going to say, if it was true, if life is a movie, so to speak, are we really choosing to have the second cup of coffee, or is that just our movie? But you answered it in that you don't think that that's the way it happens. Am I right?
Well, it starts to get to a point where it's almost unanswerable because, you know, at a certain level, you know, it's at the level of ego consciousness. Yeah, you're making a choice. Now, and there are levels where, you know, you do something or you find yourself in a certain situation that isn't really quite what you'd planned on, but for some reason is kind of where you need to be. And at some level, there's a sense of choosing that, but it is a much deeper level than, you know, choosing to have a cup of coffee, choosing, you know, what color shirt to wear in the morning, that kind of thing.
All right. What is the difference between big, and these are my words, okay? So between big mind and little mind. Little mind would be ego mind. Big mind would be something else. And where does little mind reside? I know where big mind resides, kind of. I mean, I have an odd picture in my head, but where does little mind reside?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, there's for one thing, there's, you know, in putting mind in spatial terms, you know, gets to be sort of problematic. But little mind, you know, to use that term, you know, is really not much more than this sequence of thoughts. And some of them are pleasant, some of them are unpleasant, some of them, you know, seem to have some kind of, you know, desire or aversion, you know, attached to them. You know, and that kind of almost self-generating stream is what's called little mind. You could say that bigger mind is the capacity to step back and look at that stream, and that's what a lot of meditative experiences tend.
Where do you think little mind resides? I don't know the answer to this, and I ask everybody, because is it in our electromagnetic field? I mean, it's certainly not brain. So what contains it to us?
I don't know. I mean, that, you know, in that sense, it's, you know, it's kind of a neurological, you know, question to which, you know, I'm not really entitled to answer. I mean, I suppose you could say it's in the cerebral cortex, but, you know, I don't know. That's probably what the sort of answer you'd get if you read a book on the, you know, the brain.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I don't know how far that really goes.
Okay. My next question is, and I'm going to ask this, and I'm going to use something that I found in your book. Do you believe that there is gradients in consciousness? That you make a quote in your book, is it Maurice Nicole? Is that his
mm-hmm.
name? I hate to say it. That says,
yeah.
A change in the time sense characterizes higher degrees of consciousness. So that would mean, I guess, that you believe there's gradients in consciousness.
Yeah. And some of it has to do with an ability to transcend ordinary limits of time and space. That is to say, sometimes, and that's what that quote is probably talking about, you know, an experience of timelessness, you know, So, yeah, I would say there are gradients of consciousness, and that's a little bit what I was talking about earlier, you know, these different levels ranging from, and usually in the mystical tradition portrayed in some sort of hierarchical terms, like the conscious mind is somehow below, you know, the higher self,
mm-hmm.
and so on. So, yeah, I would certainly say there are gradients of consciousness. Now, you know, are these absolutes? I mean, you know, are these like absolutely fixed categories that you can easily sort things into? I don't know that I necessarily believe that. I think it's a continuum, and like the color spectrum, which is a, you know, it's a continuum, but we do find it useful to break up into different, you know, bandwidths of colors, and we make it possible to talk about color in that way. And I think similarly, we can talk about these different levels of gradient and consciousness while realizing that to some extent, breaking it up in whatever way we do is, you know, simply a way of making it easier to talk about.
Are you familiar with David Hawkins' book, Power versus Force?
Yeah.
That's kind of what I'm referring to, you know, different gradients of awareness in human beings. I mean, when I talk to somebody, as soon as they open their mouth, I know where they are if I'm talking to them about consciousness. Why do you think that occurs? I mean, like talking to a fundamentalist and trying to explain to them that the I am within all of us, that they don't get it. Why do you think that exists, that problem?
Well, again, I mean, I don't know. A standard, I mean, most answers take some form of evolutionary theory. That is to say, this person is kind of less evolved, has, you know, had fewer lifetimes or something of the sort. You know, sometimes it's, you know, just in terms of, just brains. But I mean, the minute you say that, though, you know, I've known people, you know, I have friends with, you know, astonishingly high IQs who are, you know, just as oblivious to a lot of the stuff as a typical fundamentalist. So it's not an IQ thing in general. I think to some extent, and you know, this goes back to, you know, the Greeks. The Greek philosophers, I mean, what really characterizes intelligence is a genuine desire to know, and a desire to know that's sincere enough, and this is what Socrates was all about, to say, well, no, I want to know, but it turns out I don't really know this. And, you know, all of the dialogue with Plato where he goes and asks some expert or putative expert, and, you know, what is courage and what is this and that, and it turns out that, you know, the putative expert knows even less than he does. I think that desire to know and that, shall we say, a certain kind of sincerity or authenticity, you know, is characteristic of intelligence or something like enlightenment. Now, the minute you say that, you know, it doesn't have necessarily a lot to do with IQ in a certain sense. I think with a lot of people, you know, and the fundamentalist mindset, you know, certainly exists in religion, but it exists in lots of other areas as well. But that kind of mindset is, you know, I have taken reality and I'm explaining it according to this system that makes sense to me. Now, what I'm doing, you know, and frankly, I feel comfortable with this, so I don't really feel too comfortable with anything else. And, you know, I feel threatened by any challenge to this, and that's why people get very, very emotional about it. It's sort of saying, well, I just have to explain it all in terms of, you know, the Bible or Marxism or, you know, the laws of physics or whatever your favorite form of fundamentalism is. And you're just hanging on to that. Now, all of these systems, any system is, you know, got its strengths and weaknesses and its good points and bad points. A person who really wants to know, in the sense that I've been talking about, yeah, well, this system is right, you know, this philosopher is right, this religion is right at a certain point. It doesn't really seem to be good with these other things. You know, and it's a capacity to, you know, and this is never a fixed point. I mean, the idea if you feel that, you know, I've sorted it all out, you know, for once and for all, it's usually probably a sign of danger, and it's a sign of fundamentalism. You know, now I understand everything.
Yeah,
and it's just never like that. I mean, we have to face the very, very real possibility that, you know, the universe is more than, you know, the human mind, certainly in its familiar forms, can understand. I mean, the analogy, you know, you could take would be that of an ant. Now, an ant, you know, performs a very useful and vital role in the, you know, ecosystem of the Earth. does the ant kind of understand this ecosystem? Well, probably not. And, you know, and, but you can't say, it's not like some sort of conspiracy that somebody didn't sit the ant down and tell it what was going on. It's just beyond its capacity to think.
Right.
And I think we have to ask whether that's not true of ourselves as well.
All right. I have one more question. It's 8:47. We have to finish up at 8:58.
Uh-huh.
So you can take as little time or as much time as you want on this question, and then I'm going to let you talk about whatever you want to talk about that we haven't talked about, or
okay.
Even if we have talked about it.
Okay.
What happens when enlightenment occurs? I know what happened to me. It happened overnight, and I wasn't seeking it. I just woke up, and I went to bed one night being a fundamentalist, and the next morning I was not. What
uh-huh.
happened?
Uh-huh. Well, the way I would understand and experience it, to the extent that I have, if I have, is comes down to what I called a little bit earlier, some kind of detachment. That is to say, suddenly you realize you're not your physical body. That is to say, you're not this band of sensations and impressions that you have, because there's something there that can see all of this. And then you take another step back and you realize, well, I'm not really these thoughts and images either, because I can step back and look at these things, and there's mm-hmm. kind of this, almost like a pure witness, and that sometimes, the yoga mm-hmm. Philosophers would call it something like that. And that sense that you are not this whole bundle of things that you've identified with, and the Buddhists use, for example, words or skandhas, which literally means bundles. The fact that you can step back from this and, it's still going to go on, but you're not really identified with it in the same way that you were. Now, that's the definition, that's the way I would explain that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have a friend who used to be a Buddhist abbot, and I once asked him, what was like. He said, and he gave me, what the textbook answer is. That the Buddhist view is that enlightenment is a state of consciousness in which the three poisons, that is to say, desire, greed, and obliviousness, doesn't arise. That's a textbook definition, and I think I think it's worth throwing in there. I'm certainly not a certainly not enlightened in that sense. I've never really met anyone who is. But
well, you sure write about it very well. I just, when I read your book, I went, oh my God, he gets it.
I think there are, well, here's another thing. I mean, the idea that enlightenment is itself just sort of like a steady state.
Question here. Do you really think it's a steady state? Because I know that I have that thing, but I have to tell you, I also know that I oscillate like a swing going up, depending on how much I call it voltage, or how much emotion I have. I'll swing very high, but however high I go up, I'll guarantee myself to go that far backwards. But my only challenge is remembering that it's not real.
Yeah, I would say something very similar about myself. I mean, I think that what it comes down to is that enlightenment, or at least enlightenment as, we know it and can experience it ourselves, and not, something that's described in a textbook that happened to somebody 2,500 years ago. I mean, I think it is this sense of freedom from this entanglement in your own emotional and physical and whatnot issues. Now, there are times when you feel, fairly free from it, and you're able to look at it in a sort of, almost more objective way. And that's usually accompanied with a feeling of a certain type of joy, because you're not quite, immersed in it. But certainly speaking for myself personally, there are times when, it's not there, and then there are times when I'm in a bad mood. The difference is that, I think if you do have this kind of recognition, I think this is maybe what you're talking about, if you have this kind of recognition once, it's never really going to go back to the way it was before.
Yeah. So you can't forget how to ride a bicycle.
Yeah, I mean, there's, and that is, I think that genuine awakening is like that. I mean, you know, you can forget and you can lose it and you get upset and whatnot. And I don't know anybody that's, you know, beyond that. But, you know, there's something else and this is not all that it is. Whereas if you're not, shall we say, it's some kind of, you know, you really do kind of believe that's all it is, and it's a feeling of kind of panic and, you know, being driven back and forth. And that's what we're seeing a lot in society today where, you know, people are just, you know, people have lost faith in religion, so they don't have those things to cling to anymore. So now it's, you know, just buying the next thing and, your economic identity, you know, this is all who you are. And that's a pretty bad place to be in. And, America as a society is collectively that. I think people are trying to wake up, you know, and there is this kind of urge toward a collective awakening.
Mm-hmm.
But, there's also a sense, I mean, there do seem to be a lot of forces that are militating against it. Whether these are conscious forces, you know, like the dark brotherhoods of, you know, occult lore, or whether it's just, the inertia of the human mind is it's a fairly deep and intricate question, but sometimes it looks like one, sometimes it looks like the other. So,
yeah. Personally, I think it's the mass consciousness, you know. Noetic Sciences just did a study, and I can't remember if it's 20 years or 30 years that they conducted this study, but they said since the early to mid-80s, there have been more spontaneous awakenings than ever before in the history of time at one time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there obviously is something like that going on, we're hearing it, and in terms of kind of a mass movement, I think for everything, it's a time of disorientation because, the old certainties, even the old certainties you didn't like, are no longer true, and you don't even have the comfort of familiarity. One channeled entity for kind of street. I'm not a big fan of channeled entities for reasons that are too complicated to get into here. But he likened the current situation, you know, humanity and the earth is sort of like everything is under repair. So you know things are kind of torn up because disrupted because it's under construction. Sort of sense, and that rang true to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't easily admit this, especially on the air, because I try to stick my show, based on science, or at least people like you who have gone to a large degree to study it. But that's what happened to me when I woke up the next morning. I started channeling this entity called Seth. That's very much, if you read Jane Roberts' work and you read my book, you'll go, oh, my God, that's got to be the same source of information.
Yeah.
But anyway, we have about 3 minutes. I can keep asking questions, or you can talk about the theosophy, or is there anything you want to talk about before we hang up? Got about two, 3 minutes.
I think one end cap to this that would be interesting. It is the theme of the last chapter of my book, we as a civilization are becoming more interested in consciousness and finding out what consciousness is and what it really means in all sorts of ways. You know, it's becoming, you could almost say it could become the project of the next civilization. And I think to some extent it is. And, you know, this may be, people are doing it in lots of ways that seem incompatible. You know, the whole brain research thing makes everything sound very deterministic. And a lot of times they act as if they know it, or sound as if they know what's going on, when it's very clear they don't, at least in some kind of complete sense. But I think, you know, and the kind of, you know,
things I've been thinking about and writing about, the, you know, Institute of Noetic Sciences. I think there is just this enormous interest in consciousness and really finding out what it is, you know, not only in its often the obvious forms, but at the deeper reaches. It's one of the, you know, I think it's one of the projects that our civilization is setting for itself. And I think, you know, human society is to progress or evolve in any true sense of the word. That will be one of the biggest projects that it takes on next.
I agree with you. I really do. So what about, what is the, we had about a minute. What about the Theosophy Society? I have to bring that up because I lecture over there occasionally, and I promised them I would.
Oh, well, the Theosophical Society was founded in 1875 in New York. It's now headquartered in India, but it's basically an organization of people who want to, you know, study these kinds of the powers latent in man, and that's the programmatic statement of the Theosophical Society. And it's not so much a series of dogmas or beliefs, although, you know, some people in the society do see it that way. But I think it's more about wanting to explore, you know, the outer and inner reaches of human nature, and to do so in an ethical and responsible way, because, you know, a sense of human brotherhood is another very, very important part of the Theosophical Society's program.
Yes. So, these are located around the country, right? Because we really need to hang up, but I want people to be able to go and find. They're located probably one in every state, right?
Yeah. If you're interested, the website, you can just Google Theosophical Society, or the website is theosophical.org. And, there are lodges across, that's a big, the local organizations are called lodges. The headquarters are in the U.S. are in Beaton, Illinois, which is not coincidentally the town next door to where I live. The headquarters are in Adyar, which is in Chennai, India. It used to be called Madras. It's been located there for some time, so it is very, very international. And I think it's very good in that, you know, people don't have to believe anything, but, you know, it's also not rationalistic in the sense that, you know, you it's willing to, it's for people who are open-minded and reasonable and willing to consider far-out ideas, but who are not necessarily.
Okay, my producer just broke in and said I have to go, but thank you, Dr. Schmoly. I appreciate your time and your
interest
in my show. And sorry to ask so many hard questions, but I just want to know.
No, very, very fascinating. Thanks very much.
Thanks and good night.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher, author of Integral Health. Integral Health. You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health. Just tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m. to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Harris.